Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. It's been a while since I've been in this chair. Hope I remember how. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is our technical producer. And glad you could be with us this morning. During the first hour of the show today, we will talk about heirlooms, artifacts, and family treasures. A variety of things that we probably all have, photographs, books, papers, letters, textiles, a variety of things that we all probably have and probably care about. And we'll talk about how to care for these items, how to preserve them, and make sure that they continue to be artifacts. We have two guests with us. We've done the show, I think, once or twice before. Our guest this morning, Jennifer Hain-Tepper. She's head of the Department of Conservation at the University of Illinois Library. And Krista D.C. Quinn is collection manager at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois. They're here to take your questions, and they have a wide range of experience and expertise on caring for collections of various types, whether those are, you know, the kind of museum and library collections or personal artifacts that we all have. Jennifer Hain-Tepper is associate professor and head of conservation at the University of Illinois Library, like I said. She manages the conservation lab where book, paper, and other library materials are repaired and preserved, including many rare books, manuscripts, and photographs. She also advises on the care and protection of library collections. Krista D.C. Quinn is the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois, and she supervises collections, preservation, and works with various types of artifacts, including textiles, clothing, and ethnographic collections. A wide variety of very interesting things over the Spurlock Museum as well as the library. So, again, they are here to answer your questions. That's what this is all about. If you would like to join us, the phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you're listening around the Midwest here, or if you're listening on the Internet, you can use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Your questions are welcome. And both of you, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here again. And before we get going, I wanted to make sure that we mention the Preservation Emporium coming up on February 21st. You want to say something, Jennifer?
Sure. Yes, we're hosting the Preservation Emporium. That's going to be at the Spurlock Museum on February 21st from noon to 4. It is a free and open to the public event that is hosted by the Preservation Working Group, which is a working group here on campus that brings together collection managers and preservation professionals around campus who have experience with a wide variety of different types of materials. The program is kind of a la Antiques Roadshow in the fact that you can bring in anything that you own or have interest in from your personal belongings, and we'll have different tables set up around the space and different professionals advising on how to care for those materials. Do want to make it clear we are not doing any sort of appraisal. Unlike Antiques Roadshow, that's not our job. It's actually unethical for us as preservation managers to do that sort of thing. But we will look at anything that you bring in and be able to advise on its care, its storage, and possible treatment, as well as give advice about professionals that you can contact if you're looking for treatment for artifacts. And we'll have people in doing natural history. We'll have people doing textiles, art and decorative objects, papers, photographs, books.
You name the material type and we will work with
it. Music. lots of information on music, photographs, even a little bit on digital media. So.
And films, pictures.
Mm-hmm.
We are excited about everything.
Yes.
This is the third year this has happened. Is that correct?
This is. And it's been a very successful event, and we look forward to getting even more people in this year. We also do have a guest speaker, a keynote speaker for that event. And it's going to be Mark Pollard, who is actually from DePaul University. And he will be speaking on the role of photography in the way that we recollect Abraham Lincoln. And that's going to be at the, what's the name of your auditorium, Krista?
The Knight Auditorium at 1 o'clock.
Yes, and that'll last about an hour. And I do want to note that we're also going to have a raffle. And we've collected a really exciting set of freebies to be able to give out. And that's going to be directly after the keynote speaker. So not only can you get great advice, listen to an excellent speaker speak about a really interesting topic, especially this year with all the excitement about celebrating Lincoln. We were really excited to get a speaker who's going to be able to speak about Lincoln. But we'll also be able to give some really great preservation giveaways at the end.
And bring your family, because we also will have some really wonderful children activities as well.
Great. Spurlock Museum is just to the east of the Kranich Center for the Performing Arts. Very easy to find. wonderful place. It's just, if you haven't been to the Spurlock, it's just worth the visit, period, and especially for this event, I would say. I should also, though, mention, because in the interest of full disclosure, I've been involved in the Preservation Working Group for the past, well, I don't know, 3-4 years.
Indeed, five, more like that.
Yeah. So I just wanted to make sure that I didn't not say that.
No, it's been a great group, and we really are equally interested in our ability to help out the public and caring for their belongings, but also obviously looking out for the university's belongings and preserving those. So,
well, the issue there is so much to preserve. I mean, there's artworks, there's statues, there's architectural features, let alone millions of books and photographs, things like that.
Mm-hmm. We've got a big job ahead of us, and the challenge, especially on the campuses, is that very few units on campus are able to afford positions like mine and Krista's, where you have a full-time person really thinking about the preservation of their artifacts. And so we feel that, the role of this group is to really advise the rest of the campus about thinking on how to best preserve their interest, because the entire campus has such fantastic collections. And some of them aren't formal collections. Some of them are in departments where you just have a closet full of neat old stuff that has a history for your department, and making sure that those types of belongings are preserved as well, not just the formal museum collections or the formal library collections. So,
and most items that, when they were produced, were only meant for a couple of generations. They weren't meant for the longevity that we have. I mean, we have our oldest artifact is 100,000 years old.
What is that?
It's a projectile point.
Cool.
So it's an axe, and it's from Africa. And so we have very old pieces, and we also have very modern pieces. And I tell my students that just because something's old doesn't mean it's fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some pieces that are very old that are in excellent condition. Then we have some modern pieces, as when we talk about paper. Paper probably isn't as well produced as it was a while ago, is it?
Absolutely. I would actually concur that sometimes the oldest stuff is the most robust. There's a reason that it's lasted that long. And books are an excellent example of that, where a lot of our materials were made much, much better 500 years ago than they are being produced now. I think everybody has had that experience of buying a brand new book and opening it, and it falls apart in your hands. So some of our challenges in the library are honestly the newer stuff, more so than the older stuff.
How about that? Well, we'll talk more about that. We have a caller waiting to join us. Why don't we talk with them, see what they have to ask.
Excellent.
And we'll go to a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I wanted to ask about fluorescent lights and these compact fluorescents. My understanding is that fluorescent light has UV in it, and it can damage artworks over time. And I understand that either plastic or glass, I'm not sure which, between the light and the objects it illuminates, can reduce the amount of ultraviolet light. And so thus, I'm wondering if that's true. And then if so, would having a compact fluorescent you can get with some that are like spotlights or floodlights that are surrounded by an extra layer of diffuser. One of those are better. Any thoughts?
Sure. Krista, do you want to take that one?
I'll take that. Not to sound very unenvironmental here, but the compact fluorescents do kick out a bit of UV that really doesn't help preservation. So we don't use those in the museum. We tend to use more incandescents and that kind of thing because of the light quality. Now, you brought up an excellent point that there are filtering agents out there, and those things can be purchased. And we use sometimes, if we've had to use fluorescent light in the past, we have it's a clear film that you put next to the glass so that it really reduces the UV. And also adding to that, that's why you don't want to put any of your pieces that you really care about in direct sunlight so that they would fade or have any kind of damage.
So the film that you're talking about would go over the glass of the artwork?
Well,
over the glass of the fixture that's producing the light.
Well, if you have a framed piece, they do have UV glass, but we usually are putting it. If you have a light box, we usually put it beneath that so that then it acts as a barrier between the light and the piece itself, which in most homes may not be practical.
Could you wrap it around a long tube?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. They do have those type of things. They have them in plexi, so it's like a hard tube, or they have it in a mylar or like a kind of plastic wrap kind of consistency.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the one thing I would add to that is that the sleeves that you can actually buy for the UV tubes, depending on which type you buy, have a different life expectancy because eventually the product that you add to that sleeve will deteriorate because of its interaction with the UV light. And make sure that you note what its longevity is supposed to be and keep an eye on that because eventually it will poop out. So you want to make sure that you don't have this false sense of security that, oh, I put a sleeve up there and it's good forever because it's usually not. They actually last somewhere usually between 5 and 10 years, which is a pretty good lifespan. But you still want to monitor that because you want to make sure that obviously that UV isn't leaking out.
Imagine it's kind of like reapplying your sunscreen. You don't just apply it once. Sometimes you have to apply it several times. So with this... Jennifer has an excellent point that you really do want to just write down when you did that. And maybe when you change the light bulb, if the light bulb lasts a couple of years, you change the film at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the UV blocking glass, that if you were going to glaze something within a picture frame or if you were going to use plexiglass, also has some UV blocking characteristics just by its very nature, although it's not as thorough as official UV blocking materials, that those tend to last quite a bit longer because they're not getting that direct hit, unlike something that would be right up against the light bulb. So those do tend to last quite a bit longer.
Well, I have two ancestral portraits of my husband's that came down through my husband's family. Well, there are people who lived in the probably 1800s. I have to go look it up. Large oil paintings. Does that sort of thing need to be protected? They're out of the sunlight, and I only have I have some track lights that are on them periodically, but not continuously, with these little curly-cued bulbs in them, and I'm not sure what to do about that. I don't know how much I have to worry about it.
Generally, oil paints are done with pigments, which tend to be much more light-stable than dyes. So things like color photographs, some watercolors, and that sort of thing tend to be much more what we consider to be fugitive or light-sensitive than oil paintings. The oil paintings generally are reasonably light-stable. That said, direct light on them still can be damaging over time. So I would say that taking some precaution and going ahead and putting some sort of... Generally, people don't like to glass over an oil painting because it really distracts from the way you look at the painting. So I would say in that case, you'd probably want to look at either getting a low UV emission bulb, which they do exist, or looking at sleeving that bulb so that you're protecting those paintings. But they're not going to be as sensitive as, say, a photograph or a piece of paper.
And it's good that you have it out of the sunlight. And I would also recommend as well, since it's out in the open, that you don't really hang it near a fireplace, which quite often people hang things because of the soot and different things coming out of that can damage the paint over time, or near any air vents.
Another comment with relative to this is that we have a room that has a good-sized north-facing window, and I hung in it... I was lazy taking it down, a paper star light, and the paper was blue. And I was surprised at, even though the fact that it was not facing north, the side of the star facing the outside faded quite a bit in not a very long, just a couple of months' time.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it wasn't direct sunlight, so somehow there was... UV bouncing back in, I guess.
Exactly. Light does bounce. I mean, that's how your room becomes visibly light, even though you're not getting direct sunlight, is that the rays do bounce around, and UV bounces with that light. So if there's indirect sunlight, you are still getting some UV. You're not getting nearly the amount as direct sunlight, but that's not to say that you're not getting any. And that is a good example of dyes that were used to tint that paper star, and dyes on paper are one of our number one problems with UV fading. And they probably used it's a paper star. They probably didn't use a terribly permanent dye because it's ephemeral piece, or a piece that wasn't meant to last forever. And so what you saw was the dyeing of that really, or the bleaching of that really fugitive dye.
Hope the caller will forgive me for moving on. We have a couple other people waiting, and we'll get right to them. Just want to mention again that this morning during this hour, Focus 580, we're talking about the care and preservation of family treasures, heirlooms, artifacts, etc. Our guests, Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of the Department of Conservation at the University Library, and Krista D.C. Quinn, collection manager at the Spurlock Museum, both here at the University of Illinois. The phone number, if you'd like to join us, we have plenty of time left, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have a listener next on line number two in Sydney. Good morning.
Hi. I have a couple things I wanted to ask about. The first is I have what I think is a tintype of my great-great-grandparents, and two of them, and one of them is broken into two pieces, and I'm wondering how I can get that restored. And then the second is I have an indenture, or I guess it's a deed, from 1807 on vellum, I think it is, and I wonder what the best way to preserve that is.
Okay. I'll be able to talk to both of those, I believe, although Krista can chime in with the parchment a little bit because it is an animal hide, so that's a good crossover piece for the two of us. As far as the tin type goes, tin types are actually usually rather robust. They're actually on iron. The name for a tin type is a misnomer. They're actually they're on sheets of iron, actually. If you hold a magnet up to it, it's actually a magnetic metal.
Okay, then this is not a tin type. It's on glass.
Ah, okay. Then you have an ambrotype, actually.
Ambrotype.
Yes, and those are definitely more fragile than tin types, and they do frequently break. What I would recommend is, depending on what your goal is, re-adhering glass into a seamless repair where you can't see the crack is very, very difficult and, to be honest, very expensive because it would be something that you'd have to go to a professional photographic conservator to have them take care of that. There are different ways that it could be displayed. However, if it's a clean break where you could actually just abut the two pieces of glass next to each other, you'll still be able to see the crack, but you'd be able to see the image. Does this still have its black backing to it, or is it clear?
I think it's clear. I don't recall that I've actually taken it apart. I don't have it in my possession. My mother has it.
Okay.
I can't look at it right now.
Okay. The amber types, the way they're displayed, they're actually a really, really neat photographic process where the way they're made is that a white emulsion, as opposed to what we traditionally think of as black when photographs are printed, a white image is formed on the back of that sheet of glass, and then you actually display it over a black background, and that makes the image look positive to us.
I wonder if this is some other type then, because the image is sort of brown.
Like just creamy brown, like a light caramel, or like really dark, more like sepia. Or coffee brown.
It's kind of like sepia, I guess.
And it's on glass.
And it's on glass.
Yeah, daguerreotype would be on metal. I'm trying to think what that might be. And it's a positive image. It's not a negative image.
It's a positive image.
Okay. My best guess then is that what you probably have is a lantern slide. LATERN, like a light lantern, and then slide, like a 35-millimeter slide. And what those are is actually a really early slide, just like 35-millimeter slides. They were the first format for projecting images by transmitting light through them.
I see.
Typically, they're usually about 3x5, 3x4 inches.
Right.
They'll typically have black tape or red tape around the edges of them, and that held two sheets of glass together. There's one that actually has the image on it, and then typically, although not always, there's another protective sheet of clear glass on the back that protects the emulsion layer. Sometimes, depending, especially if it's been broken, you may have lost that protective second sheet of glass. But those are quite fragile and do frequently break. With those, then the purpose is that translucency because they were meant to be projected. Again, it's very difficult to meld that glass seamlessly. So what I would do is there are conservators, photographic conservators available in the Chicago area. I don't want to recommend anybody specifically because I'm honestly not familiar with the work that comes from any specific photo conservators in the area. They could look at rehousing that object in a way to abut those two pieces of broken glass so that it can be displayed safely.
Well, you know, they're displayed as photographs in frames.
Oh.
They don't appear that they've been designed to be projected.
It's possible that they are slides and they just have a solid background mounted to them so that they look, so that they are being shown as a photograph. Because, of course, you could take a 35-millimeter slide and put a white background on it and see the image on a 35-millimeter slide, even though it's not being projected. With a bigger lantern slide, that's even easier because the image is much larger. So that would be my best guess at what you're what you're looking at. Without seeing it, it's kind of difficult. Lantern slides typically do tend to be more black than a sepia, but that's my best guess without being able to see it. But I think, honestly, if it's broken but it is framed and solid and being held together, you're probably doing everything you can for it right now.
Okay.
As far as the deed goes onto the parchment, how do you have that housed right now? Is it just in an envelope somewhere?
Actually, right now it's just loose. It's sort of tied together.
Okay. Is it something that you just want to preserve, or is it something you'd actually like to display or be able to bring out and show people periodically?
Well, it's been folded, and so it's fairly large. So I think what I'd like to do is just periodically look at it. I'm trying to transcribe the whole thing and show it to people who are interested.
Okay. Parchment and vellum, it's probably actually on vellum. There's a very subtle difference between vellum and parchment. Parchment is a thinner material. It could be parchment. A lot of times for deeds and indentures, they actually use a slightly heavier material just because these were meant to be very permanent materials. It could be on either. And physically, the care for vellum versus parchment is identical. What vellum and parchment are they're animal hides, typically goat, calf, sheep sometimes, that are stretched and salted, but not actually tanned like traditional leather. And so chemically, parchment and vellum are actually far more similar to a rawhide dog chew than they are to, say, a leather belt or a glove. And if you've played with dogs and rawhide dog chews, then you know what happens when those get wet, and they absorb water quite quickly. And vellum and parchment will do the same thing from humidity in the air. And so what you want to do is to protect this from dramatic swings in relative humidity so that the vellum or parchment doesn't expand and contract, which will stress out the object over time. Now, if you're looking at trying to have it open to be able to look at it frequently, what I would recommend is that you open it gradually. And honestly, it will be easier in the summer when you have a little humidity in the air. The likelihood of it cracking when it's dry is not high, but it is still more of a risk during the winter when it's really dry out. So wait until the summer when you've got some humidity. The object's going to be a little bit more flexible, and then very gently open it and put gentle weight over some of the areas and start to press it flat. And this is going to be a slow, gradual process. A lot of preservation is not something that you can do quickly. You want to gently ease the object into what you want it to do. And then try to actually store it flat, because the more you open and close it, the more risk you're going to have for actually breaking along those folds.
Right.
And I'd also like to add to that, and I'm glad you brought up, you know, where fluctuations and humidity is, that we want to talk to the listeners and make sure that people are not storing things in their basements or attics. I know that sometimes that's where a lot of these objects end up being, but those are places with wild temperature and humidity fluctuations, which really do not help any of our collections. So you'll probably be hearing that over and over again, but you definitely want to store it as best as you can in pretty much where you live, because that's going to have less fluctuation.
Absolutely.
Okay. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me. We have a couple people waiting, and we're already almost at our midpoint here, taking your questions on preserving and caring for family treasures, artifacts, vellum objects, whatever. if you'd like to join us, we have a couple lines open, a couple people waiting. The phone number around Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Another listener in Champaign, next on line number three. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi. I had a question. I wondered if one of your guests could point me in the right direction to get this accomplished, or maybe I would need to come to the event that they mentioned. I have a board, which was we were re-roofing the house, and one of the pieces of sheeting came off, and on the underside of it, a carpenter had signed and dated this board. With a pencil. So it's kind of a nice artifact to validate to some degree the age of our house and when it was built. A couple of things. The writing is rather dim. I wondered if there was any way to enhance that and then to preserve and protect it.
As far as the writing, I think I want to defer to Jennifer. Well, I mean, I don't know of any techniques to darken that kind of thing. The nice thing is that you found it. It's no longer up on the roof. When we were talking about wild fluctuations in temperature and relative humidity, well, your roofing material would be suffering from that. So you brought it inside. And what's its condition besides that? Is it warped? Is it in good shape?
No, it's in good shape. The piece of wood is in fine condition. And again, it's just it's really hard to see the writing. But, I mean, if you get it in just the right angle and, you know, you've studied it for a while, I know what it says. And I just wondered if there was some way to improve or enhance that, something that would you could apply that would the graphite or whatever, I don't know. I'm sure this was written with some kind of a carpenter's pencil.
Well, what's your goal for this particular piece?
Well, I'd like to display it as something relating to our house.
Well, what I was wondering is if we can't find anything, which I'm not sure if we're going to be able to recommend a product that is going to enhance the writing, is perhaps you can have a photographer photograph it at an angle where you could see that, and then you can put the photograph next to the board, and that way you don't have to manipulate the piece to see that.
Well, that's a possibility, yeah.
Well, the other thing, just following on that, Krista, in Photoshop you could certainly enhance the quality of the writing, you know, if you had a digital photograph. Mm-hmm. It's easy to adjust the contrast to bring out the writing.
And we've actually recommended that to a number of people who have signatures who are done in felt-tip pens, because felt-tip pens do fade really quickly. And we've had to do that at the library, recommend that from the library to several people, is to take a digital photograph, have someone, if you're good with Photoshop, actually do it yourself, or have someone who's more experienced with it, tweak with the contrast to really bring the signature up to the front, and then to display that with the original. To answer your question about trying to enhance graphite, chances are, if it truly is graphite, which I would guess, given that it was a carpenter, it probably is. It probably was never any darker, because graphite doesn't fade. So that probably what you're looking at is actually what their signature looked like originally. And so to try to enhance that actually would ethically for us as preservation professionals would be misleading, because that isn't what the original signature looked like. Graphite is actually very, very stable. It's based on carbon pigments and doesn't fade over time. And so what you're looking at is what the signature looked like the day he signed it.
And the same rules would apply for display. You don't want to put it in direct light. You want to make sure that it's in, you know, a good stable environment, and watch your UV.
Right. And actually, display-wise, sorry, I would also recommend that you cover it, because graphite is what we consider to be a friable material, so that it actually is dust sitting on top of that wood. And so any abrasion could actually result in some loss of that image.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking that it might have gotten dimmer, because that the roof sheeting, of course, gets tremendously hot. That some of it may have just gradually disappeared. This board is facing down.
It is possible that some of the particulate actually fell off with the shifts in temperature. That is possible.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, great. Thanks very much for your information.
Thanks for the call. We have several people waiting. We'll go next to someone on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
We have some lithographs from the late 1800s and early 1900s that were in the Chicago Tribune. We found them in an old trunk in a house we purchased. I had them framed, and we used acid-free mounting stuff. Is there any other way to preserve them? They're in a dining room on a wall that is not exposed to direct sunlight.
Okay. I think we'll probably repeat some of what we mentioned to the woman who had the was asking about the fluorescent lighting. Anything based on paper is going to be highly susceptible to light damage, even if it's not direct light damage. They took a great first step by looking at quality matting and framing materials. I would add that in addition to looking for acid-free materials, you want to ideally, for paper materials, look at something that has what's called a buffer, an alkaline buffer in it, which most likely the material that you purchased, if you got good quality framing material, probably has. But I just want to mention that to other people to know that that's something that you want to look for. And what that buffered material, that buffered mat board actually does is help to absorb acids that the paper may produce as it ages. And that actually greatly extends the longevity of your paper materials by having it housed in that sort of material. But in addition, I'd say your major concern, if you've got it in good quality mat board, is going to be the potential for light damage and, again, swings in relative humidity and temperature. So I'd say the ideal for that is to make sure that you have a good quality glass glazing in the frame, and you want to look for UV blocking glass or UV blocking plexiglass as the glazing material, and then that you also want to make sure that the room that you have it displayed in has a relatively stable temperature and relative humidity, because paper does degrade much quicker when you have rapid fluctuations in both your humidity and temperature in the space.
We have it mounted on ragboard. Is that all right?
Yes, ragboard is an excellent quality material. What ragboard means is that you've got paperboard composed of completely either cotton or linen fibers, so that you've got no impurities in the paper, and that means it's a really good quality board.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. Several callers waiting. Let me just mention again that we are talking this morning with Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of the Department of Conservation at the University Library, and Krista D.C. Quinn, collection manager at the Spurlock Museum, both at the University of Illinois, taking your questions on care and preservation of family treasures. And also mention again that on Saturday, February 21st, our guests and many other people involved in the preservation community on the campus here are presenting a preservation emporium, heirlooms, artifacts, and family treasures at the Spurlock Museum that is free and open to the public noon to 4 p.m. on Saturday, February 21st. So it's an opportunity for you to bring in some items and get some expertise and guidance on caring for them. So there you go. Several callers waiting, and we'll go next to someone in Champaign. Line number two is next. Good morning.
Hi, I have a question about preserving video and film. My late husband was a filmmaker, and I have films of his on 16mm, on beta tapes, and on VHS tapes, and he's no longer with us, so I would like to preserve these things as best I can.
Well, audiovisual material is a challenge for all of us, unfortunately. I would say that in general, the just to review, you said you had it on beta, on VHS, and on 16mm film?
Yeah.
Okay. The 16mm film is actually going to be the most stable of those three, and I would say in general, as long as you have the film, again, kind of following general preservation guidelines, keep it somewhere cool with a stable temperature, stable relative humidity, and out of direct sunlight, then the film is actually going to be reasonably long-lived. I'm assuming this was made since the 40s, that it's fairly recent film.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, the polyester-based film is actually remarkably stable. If it's color film, keeping it in the dark is really critical because the dyes that make the color image can actually shift over time, and dark, cool storage is the number one way to slow down that potential dye shift.
Okay.
You also want to make sure that they are properly cored and boxed to provide the most stability and support to the object. And there are lots of great guidelines online. The National Film Preservation, Jack, help me out here. I'm not remembering the NFPA, National Film Preservation Association, has a film preservation guide.
They do, yes.
Okay.
That has some great guidelines for basic film preservation. That it's online, it's available as a download. It's an entire book, but they have it up available online as a PDF for people to reference for free.
Excellent.
And it's an excellent guide for film preservation and care. As far as the VHS and beta goes, those two actually are far less long-lived, especially if they were just commercially made and not professional quality products, which depending on what sort of what sort of budget he was working with. Those films can be quite not only obsolete, of course none of us have Betamax players anymore, but even VHS players are getting harder and harder to come by, but in addition the physical material can be stretched, can lose its magnetization over time,
mm-hmm.
and those can be real challenges. And so while the physical object in those cases sometimes does have some personal value or some value to the object, I would recommend reformatting to a more stable media in that case.
Okay.
In many cases right now that is going digital, and by saying that a digital media is stable, that means that you're committing yourself to reviewing that data and migrating it as technology changes. So you would be committing yourself to constant migration. But that is, unfortunately, pretty much what all audiovisual material since film is requiring these days. It's constant migration from format to format as the technology changes.
Okay.
And I would like to encourage you, if you are able to come to the Preservation Emporium. We have Jimmy Jones there who can...
Yes.
He's
a film guy, and he'd be great to... He'd do a splendid job looking at your pieces and judging their condition, and we will have... he has playback equipment in some cases for, I think, film usually he has there.
They usually
have a projector there.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing. And we encourage all the listeners to come to the Emporium as well. Mm-hmm. But if you have the opportunity, you should try and make it.
Right. But I would say, Krista and I, neither of us are audiovisual specialists, but Jimmy Jones, who will be at the Emporium, is. And he can answer very, very specific questions and be able to look and actually assess the condition of your materials.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Great.
Thanks for the call. Also, Emma Sato Lincoln will be there. And she's an audiovisual specialist as well, preservation
Correct.
Specialist. Before we get on to some of the callers, just a comment on the videotape situation we're facing. It is soon to be a massive die-off, if one uses that metaphor, of magnetic media in general, and in particular the VHS and the home video kinds of videotapes, which probably won't last longer than 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have, if something is valuable, it's important to get at it pretty quickly,
yes,
I would say.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And there are more stable magnetic media, such as actual beta format, not the home beta format.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, the digital preservation issue is very complicated because of the evolution of the technology. It's so fast.
Yes, absolutely.
So, okay. All right. Well, with that, let's go on and talk with our next caller, someone in Georgetown, line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. I am so thankful that you put this show on, and I'm thankful I was supposed to go to an exercise class, and I got phone calls and didn't make it, and so I got to listen to the program, and it's just what I needed, so thank you so much. I have a couple things. My son-in-law is in the process of transferring 8mm film, which was taken beginning in the 40s, and thank goodness my mother did splice it together, and I think this is what helped it. She had it on big reels in metal cases in an upstairs closet in the dark. We were totally shocked that I thought it would just rip apart and fall apart. But what he's doing is he's taking the old 8mm projector, as long as we can keep getting a bulb, and he found that online, and he's like showing it on the wall or on a white background, and then he purchased a camcorder, which he's taking that picture of that's as it's being shown on the wall, and then he's transferring it to a DVD. And it's really pretty good. There's light and darkness, but that kind of was in the film when my mother used to show it when we were young kids in the 40s. So we're just thrilled that we even have it. Is there anything special that we should be doing other than that, I mean, to preserve it? And then he's going to make copies for my brothers. Is that the best route to go?
I guess one question for you first is, when you open up those metal film canisters,
right.
Does the film smell funny at all, or does it smell like vinegar, perhaps, or does it not have any particular odor?
I tell you, I have a problem with smell, so I haven't noticed it, and he hasn't said anything,
okay.
But I can certainly ask him.
It would be a pretty pungent odor. What I'm curious, in the 1940s, we were still transitioning from motion picture film from cellulose diacetate base to a polyester base.
Okay.
Polyester film is actually quite stable, but cellulose diacetate gives off acetic acid, what most people know as vinegar,
okay.
As it degrades. And that film, if it's the cellulose diacetate base, actually does need specific preservation attention, because it does degrade over time. If it's polyester, I would say this in either case, but even more so for the polyester, is hang on to the original. Don't think that
okay.
what you're transferring it to is going to last longer than the film. Chances are the film is actually going to last much longer than your DVD.
Okay.
What you're creating is a great, what we in the library feel consider a use copy, so that it's actually accessible to you. Because as you're finding out, projecting 8mm film these days is actually quite a challenge.
Right.
And there will always be professionals available that if you do need to transfer it again in the future, There are people that you can pay to do that transfer for you. Even if you can't purchase a bulb for your projector anymore, there'll be professionals who can transfer it for you. But the film is going to be, over the long haul, much more stable and a better preservation copy than any of the used copies that you're producing.
Oh, I appreciate you telling me that. That's great. Now, we also have some slides. Is there some way that they can be, or are they pretty good, that you can just leave them as a slide and do you need to do something with them?
Are they color or black and white or both?
Color.
Color slides, actually, the problem with them is that the dyes used to make color slides can fade over time. And so there are professionals out there who can transfer your slides to other medium. I'd say the safest one is actually a physical photographic print. That would be a very pricey thing to do, unfortunately, but that is something that you could do if you want to preserve the images. If you want to preserve the slides themselves, cold, dark storage is going to be your best. Light is the number one enemy of color images like that, and cold's going to slow down the degradation even more.
They are in these trays, the old Kodak, I forget what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
They're in boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I do need to do is to get them up out of the basement, right?
Yes, absolutely. Get them into an environment that's very stable
and
hopefully the coolest place you can find.
Okay. Try to even, like if it got hot, get them in where there's some air conditioning.
Exactly.
So they don't get real hot.
Exactly.
Okay. Then one other quick thing. I have the baptismal certificate of my grandmother's brother, and this was from 1875. It's all written in German, and the written part had faded, and my grandmother attached to it, she had typed this in 1954, that she took a black pen, and it looks like the kind with ink, not a ballpoint,
mm-hmm.
and she wrote over so that they wouldn't lose what the actual words were, whose it was, because it was fading so.
Mm-hmm.
It's real splotchy, but of course I want to keep it. Is there anything special I should do or can do to preserve it other than some of the things you were mentioning earlier? I didn't get on at the very beginning of the show, so I didn't hear everything, but something about special glass. I have it in a frame. Behind glass, but am I right? There's special glass.
Special glass, and the number one enemy of ink fading is going to be UV light exposure. And you're going to want to look and make sure that the glass that you have in that picture frame does block UV light.
Okay, and maybe I should not really hang it. I should just keep it in a closet. Would that be better?
That would be dark storage is always going to be better than displayed. Okay. Yeah, that's going to slow it down even more.
Okay, and you talked about this Emporium, but I didn't catch that. I came in late, so. Is that a special program or?
Yeah, it's a free event, actually, that we're going to be hosting at the Spurlock Museum on February 21st from noon to 4. And it's an open event that's free for the public to come bring in their artifacts. And we'll have professionals there to actually look at and consult on a wide variety of different types of materials, books, photographs, textiles, clothing, natural history, artifacts, art objects.
Archaeological material.
Film, audiovisual materials. You name it, we'll be able to answer questions for you.
So pack up the car, pack up some friends with cars of artifacts, and bring them to the Spurlock.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left and a couple callers waiting. We'll hopefully include both of them at least. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana, line number 3. Good morning.
Line number 2?
That's you, yes. Go ahead.
It's me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I have... 3 songsters. These are books. They're about 3x5 from the 1840s. And the only way I know the date is because they're signed. But this is Black Americana. I have all the binding, but the backboards are not in good shape. I'm keeping them in a Tupperware container, and the house is pretty well. Done, but the most important one that nobody's ever seen before is the cool white Negro American songster, forget-me-not songster. Now I want to reproduce this so I can actually sell it. Now, what do you use to reproduce this? Should I have a copy stand? I'll have to open them up. I've taken them to a professional binder conservator in St. Louis, and she tells me I shouldn't have the work done because they'll destroy the resale value. But I want to reproduce at least a cool white forget-me-not songster. So you know, I mean, they're small. They were made to be put in a rucksack. And ridden on a horseback, probably by Cool White himself. And I'd like your answer. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you've had a professional conservator already look at this, I am going to defer to her opinion since she's seen them. And as a conservator, I would say that any treatment that's going to potentially destroy the original, I would strongly discourage. I understand your desire to share the object with other people, but of course the destruction of the original is taking away that artifact from the public, and I'd imagine the paper is probably quite fragile at this point. And the ability to get a good quality image off of bound, very fragile paper frequently does result in the destruction of the object, or at least severe damage to the object. So I don't want to recommend anything that could be destructive. I'm not sure what else to say, because I feel ethically that I can't recommend a treatment that would actually damage the object. I understand that you want to reproduce it, but if it's going to cause destruction, I strongly discourage that and just try to preserve the original for as long as you can. And on that note, I would note that storage in Tupperware probably isn't ideal. Those are plastic containers, and plastic containers are inherently unstable. The best storage for book and paper artifacts is going to be in high quality, alkaline buffered, lignin-free, paperboard boxes or folders, and they're going to help to absorb some of the acids that will slow down that deterioration, because these things are only going to become more brittle over time, and you want to try to slow that down as much as possible.
Okay. We have another call waiting. We'll talk to them next. Someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I've gone to using digital cameras now, and I'm printing with a laser printer. And I'm wondering how will those prints hold up, and is there an archival paper that can be used with the printing?
Absolutely. There are good quality. Your major concern actually with digital printing is the quality of the inks that you're using, not so much the paper, although paper is also a concern.
Mm-hmm.
You said it's laser as opposed to inkjet?
Yes, it's laser. It's an HP.
Okay. Laser prints are a little bit more stable than standard inkjets, but the highest quality photographic print out there is actually an inkjet printer. Epson makes a very high-quality professional photographic inkjet printer that uses pigments as opposed to dyes. Most laser printers, as well as most common inkjet printers, actually rely on dyes for their color image formation, and dyes are inherently unstable, both with shifts in relative humidity, but also with light exposure, and they do fade quite quickly. The inkjet printer that Epson makes actually relies on pigments, which are much closer to the types of things that you use for oil painting, which are much, much, much more stable, particularly to light fading. And so ideally, if you're looking for longevity of your images, you'd really want to look for a pigment-based ink. To the best of my knowledge, although I don't print archival prints with a laser printer. I use the Epson. I don't believe there are pigment-based laser printer inks, but you want to search for that and see if that is available to you. There are also high-quality photographic papers. Epson tends to be the brand that really promotes archival-quality digital photographic printing, and so I'm most familiar with the Epson quality papers, but they do make professional-grade papers. What you want to look for, again, is high content of cotton in the paper, and lignin-free paper, and as few impurities in the paper as possible.
How fast is relatively quick degeneration?
I have seen standard inkjet printed photographs. If we lay them in direct sunlight, fade in as few as 5 days.
Oh,
not to the point that you can't see the image, but you can actually notice the fading. So those dyes are quite fugitive when they're exposed to direct sunlight.
And if they're not in direct sunlight and with a laser printer?
I haven't tested laser printers specifically. I've tested the inkjets, although they're still dye-based, so my guess is they'd be very similar. In dark storage, it's going to take quite a bit longer. I mean, you're looking at years, but if you're really thinking about these as artifacts that you want to be able to pass on to future generations, those colors are going to shift. And I would imagine we're talking, 10 or 20 years before you start seeing noticeable fading. But nonetheless, they will fade over time.
So for an exhibition print, it wouldn't make much difference.
If you're only looking at a short-term print, I think not looking at the pigment-based stuff would be just fine. It's really, you're looking at longevity.
And if you have something you want to last a long time, it might be better to get somebody with the Epson printer to print it for you.
Yes, very much so.
Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We have one last caller. We'll try to squeeze in here. We just have a couple of minutes. We'll have to be quick. Line number two, someone in Urbana. Hello.
This is a quickie. My grandfather wore a coat jacket in 1880, and I have the jacket, and I have a picture of him in the jacket. What should I cover that with? That's first question. Second question, would it be deleterious to the fabric to put it on the back of his desk chair that I have and have it just sitting there as if he took the jacket off?
Where is the is that in direct sunlight, the desk?
No. No.
Is it in a guest room or something
yes.
like that people frequently don't use?
Yes.
I mean, over time, sometimes hanging any kind of jacket or chair, over a chair, it could deform the jacket over
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're better off kind of keeping the shape of the jacket.
Okay.
And, using, that kind of I'm not recommending a store-bought mannequin form. You can do that. Or you can use acid-free tissue to put into the jacket and store in a box.
Oh.
But if your goal is to have it out, you could have it maybe on a valet.
Mm.
you know, do something like that, where that's more of the shoulder shape. But it also depends on the weight of the jacket, because sometimes, so sometimes, like, for example, you don't usually hang sweaters because they could deform on hangers.
Yeah.
It's the same type of thing. So maybe you just want to have it when you have family members come over. You could put it out on the valet. And, you know, have it, you know, and you can have it out for that kind of occasion, but otherwise keep it in a good box.
If I put it on a hanger and hang it in a closet, what covering should I put on it?
Well, you definitely don't want to use any dry cleaning bags.
Well,
those
that's
are
what I'm doing now.
Yeah, that's not that plastic, it really comes apart. If you actually touch the plastic, it kind of comes off in your hand. So, like, more of a canvas cover, that kind of thing. So out of fabric is much better. So
any fabric is better than the plastic.
Yes, do not use the plastic.
We're going to have to stop there. Unfortunately, we're just simply out of time. I want to thank the callers and also our guests, Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of the Department of Conservation. I'm trying to talk too fast. Haven't done this for a while. The head of the Department of Conservation at the University Library, and Krista D.C. Quinn, collection manager at Spurlock Museum. And they will be involved in the Preservation Emporium on Saturday, February 21st at the Spurlock Museum, noon to 4, free and open to the public, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Hope to see a lot of people out for that.
Encourage everybody to come and bring all their stuff.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.